So now we can switch to the question part, and we are going to start with the three reviewers and honor of them. We can start with Professor Marianne Huchard from University Montpellier II.
Thank you very much. So first of all, I would like to thank you for the presentation, which was really very clear, very fluent, if
thank
this
you.
Adjective can be used for a presentation in English, I don't know. And also I would like to thank you for the document that you wrote and that we had to evaluate, because it contains something that you show today too. It's some vision of a domain which is a very large domain, in fact, because looking for information in data of many different nature, it's a very large domain. And this vision is very interesting, and he made me think about my own research, so thank you very much for that, because I had to work during the summer to understand, to put my own work in perspective with what you present in your vision. So thank you for that. Also, I would like to say something about the coverage of the topics that you do and the coverage of the aspect of the research. You explained in the beginning of the talk that you have some deep theoretical contribution, and this is very important, of course, but also you take care of providing some tools, and this is very important for the community of researchers and maybe for users too, because
I
some
hope too.
Yes, because some tools are can be used by final users which are not computer scientists, of course. And and also I noticed that you try to do some experiments with real end users, and so you explained that you have to do more in that way, but it's very interesting to have all of that in your research. So I would like to congratulate you for that, and also something which is shown in your talk at the end is the fact that we have the feeling by reading the document and during the talk too that you work in a team which is a mostly cohesive team, and this is very nice to see that you don't do research in a small office and without talking with anybody. So this is something that I would like to also to thank you to express that kind of doing research, because it's I think it's important to the human part of this research is very important also for us. Okay, so now I have some questions, of course. First I would like to ask you questions about relational data, because you know it's my my own preoccupation, my own concern. And my first question would be about your vision about propositionalization and relational data, because in your document you talk about a system which is called Navigala, I think, which uses propositionalization, very difficult word to pronounce. And recently we worked on another system which is called IFI in French, IFI in English, I think, and where propositions corresponds to integration of relation inside the representation of formulas, in fact. So I would like to have your opinion about that, the opposition between not opposition but maybe the duality between you have the relation which are sparse, and doing some propositionalization, you what you do is trying to do a summary of relations and to integrate that. So
Okay. I have the same difficulty with propositionalization word in my course, in my data mining course with students, even in French. So propositionalization is really an important technique for many data mining, machine learning techniques, which cannot cope with relations directly. So it's indeed very interesting to have these techniques to kind of encapsulate those relations into simple propositions or attributes. What I explain to what I show to students by example is that there are limits to this. You can go a long way with propositionalization, but there are always a limit. And a big trade-off between how many propositions you generate and the precision of the of your propositionalization. If you want to have a very precise propositionalization, then you will end with a vast number of propositions. In fact, if you could cover, for instance, all possible patterns, if you have a big graph such as knowledge graph, you could compute all graph patterns over that that graph, and then use each of them as a as an attribute or a proposition. But generally, it's not practical. So the main drawback of propositionalization is that there is a bias, a choice a priori of what is relevant. But sometimes, if we have a knowledge about the domain that tells that those are the interesting patterns, this can be very effective. In my from my point of view, what I'm interested in would be to avoid this bias. I like to do things in generic way, even if this has consequences sometimes. So I would be interested in that case with relational data to avoid propositionalization and to try and find a way to cope with the vast set of possible relational patterns. And for instance, this can be connected to utilis, updates through interaction. Because in that case, what we've done is that we start when you update an object, the user has to specify a first description of that object. So, for instance, starting from the initial description, or from, and then we start from that description, which is a tree, and we apply a relaxation on it. But ideally, what I would like to do would be to say, okay, we have that object that is in that large graph pattern, knowledge graph. And I would like to suggest to do suggestion on how to update this object based on the relationships through the entire knowledge graph. So to avoid the bias to say, okay, I go only to a length of 3 or 4 and let's go on.
Okay.
So but this is only possible if we do it in an incremental way. So the idea would be the objective, ideally, would be to combine completeness and incrementality to have something tractable.
Okay. Okay.
So this is a perspective that was not listed, but
yes. Okay. So what I understand is that finally, to cope with the complexity of relational data, having some predefined patterns, graph patterns, and doing things incrementally are the right way to do. Okay.
Yeah. You say. And ideally, you would like. I would like to avoid any bound. You know, that the system would look up everything that is needed. If you need a pattern of length 10, it will look up to 10. If 3 is enough, it will stop at 3.
Yes. Okay.
Something like this. But it's quite open question.
Yes. Okay. Then. Okay. Yes. Maybe I have some question about relational concept analysis and versus your proposal, but maybe it could be. Some discussion long, so I would like first to ask you some general questions about what is your definition of scalability and how you think it's the right way to address scalability. I would like to precise maybe the question, and because when you have a very large number of data, like in the web, for example, you can say, okay, I will take into account all data, but also you could say, okay, this is really big data, but I would like better to explore parts, and so you have to select parts, etc. So this is my question.
Okay, so there are many possible elements of answer.
Yes.
So scalability is through that you can I'm more interested I think in the more user-centered definition of scalability, which means, does it scale for the user? Is it responsive enough for the user? There is a more technical definition of scalability that would amount to compute how much time it takes to answer queries. I think this is more relevant to people defining query engines, for instance. So here, first, this is a criteria that came relatively late in my work. last year with the master thesis of Joris Guyonvar, mm-hmm. Amir Educassé, where we work on that, and we simply reuse the performance of Sparkle endpoints to do that. And the objective was to reach a point where the system is responsive enough. Mm-hmm. And we managed to do it by only returning a partial set of answers, mm-hmm. not all answers. Mm-hmm. So this partially answer to your question, yes, about selecting, yes, a subset. So it's not, mm-hmm. reselecting a subset, but the system will just get the first, mm-hmm. 200 answers, mm-hmm. and the compute is index on those partial answers. And in this case, by tuning the number of answers, you can make it responsive mm-hmm. in any case. And then we had a problem that came from that, is that as we have only partial answers, we had only partial index, partial mm-hmm. suggestions. And so I added more recently a mechanism in Sparklis with a kind of completion, intelligent auto-completion, mm-hmm. so that the system will look if needed for more answers, but only on the need.
Okay.
Mm. And there was another point I wanted to say. Yes, about the selection of data sources. It's true that it's really a challenge to extend this to the whole semantic web. Mm. We could imagine to list all possible Sparkle endpoints, but then indeed it would certainly be interesting to allow the user to say, okay, don't look for everything,
yes,
everywhere. let me first, so we could imagine, mm. for example, to first navigate among the Sparkle endpoints, which would assume that we describe each Sparkle endpoint by topics or by the piece of vocabulary that are used. Mm. And then the user could first select a set of Sparkle endpoints, and then only those Sparkle endpoints would be queried. Mm.
Okay, so you are for reasonable scalability.
Yes, well, I'm not Google. Maybe Google, they can do it web scale, maybe.
Yes.
Because originally we didn't think that it would be possible for one company to have an index of the whole web, but it works.
Okay. Okay, so thank you. And. you will complete the question maybe after.
Yeah, I'm just saying that Google doesn't have.
So if Google doesn't have. So. Okay, and another question is about the data that you analyze. So you showed that you have several kinds of data, geographical data, comics, photos, DBpedia, and so on. Mm. And from all these experiences, are you able to define some typology of data, and say, okay, what I apply to geographical data, I can apply the same things to DBpedia, or not at all because they are so different. So, are you able to recognize something like that, or not? Maybe.
Okay. Maybe it's the reverse. Mm. In fact, I really have a strong tendency to do things in a generic way, so I'm probably ignoring specificities of different data. So I try with a generic solution, and then I see what I can do for different kinds of data, and their limits. Maybe it would be so. In some way, I find what works with everything, but I think it would be more interesting as perspectives to study what are the specificities. In fact, I see.
Okay.
I would need that more than to find the common point, because by construction what I do is generic. So
yes.
Maybe I should look more in detail to, for instance, geographical data. Mm. I know that there is an ongoing PhD with Olivier on the SODA, where they consider geographical data. Mm. And where they have looked at RDF vocabularies to represent geographical data. And sometimes it's quite complicated, and it's not clear that the approach I presented would work as is on this kind of data. Mm.
Okay, because my question was about the fact that if you study some specificities of different data sets, mm-hmm. Sometimes you can have common things, and you can improve even your tool is generic, but you can improve even the generic tool by taking into account some things that are common to many kind of data. Mm. So I don't know, but maybe this is difficult.
I don't have precise ideas.
Maybe a future work or something like that. Okay, and then Okay, then to finish, just a question about relational concept analysis, but just yes. one, because when you discuss about that kind of thing, comparing it to logical concept analysis, you say that in fact this is maybe not a good idea in relational concept analysis to have a separated classification of different category of things. And in fact, later in the document, when you talk about queries and focus, I wondered if, in fact, when we use relational concept analysis, we don't have several possible focus. And in fact, when we navigate between the different classification, this is a kind of focusing on different objects.
Yes. So. I think we can see it like this, indeed. In relational concept analysis, as far as I understand it, when you have a concept, it corresponds to a kind of graph pattern behind that with the current focus on the on the concept of the that you're looking at, so on the kind of object that this is the concept that is of. And then in the intention, there are references to other concepts.
Yes.
And the switching to that other concept may correspond to a focus change.
Yes.
But it may have to be proved, it's not clear. In the idea, it's that, but is this exactly the same graph pattern seen from different positions, or are the graph patterns somewhat different? Another difference I see, from what I understand, is that in notional concept analysis, the concept intentions are not do not correspond exactly to Sparker graph patterns. I think they are more like a combination of terminological axioms that define a concept depending on other concepts.
Yes.
So I think it's more at the intentional level, a way to discover a concept and concept definitions. Whereas here, it's more like our concept lattices, we see them in a navigation space.
Yes.
So we need one navigation space, and then we have, but it's simply because I guess some of our navigation links corresponds in your case to move from one concept lattice to another.
Yes, to the other.
So
yes,
there's probably a correspondence like this.
Okay. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The second reviewer, at least closest to me, is Professor Eero Ivonen from University of Aalto in Finland.
Yeah, thanks for this invitation and the nice presentation. I think you have had a quite nice, as we can all see now in this slide, line of research that very very nicely makes a whole and contributes to each other, and not only to each other but of course also to other people's work, which is very nice. This is very very much networked effort. I have a question, a general question first about this, the structure of the habilitation. You have here four different papers included, and then you have this PhD work, and the idea is that this habilitation should extend the PhD work, right?
Yes, and it's more a synthesis, I would say, than an extension. Of course, it's an extension because a lot of work has been done since my PhD.
Yeah.
But the motivation, the main part of the habilitation manuscript is really the synthesis part. I wanted to join the papers because there are not much technical details in the synthesis itself. So I wanted to give the possibility to look at them without just showing a long list of papers and let you choose. It's also a way to show some significant works and to identify a few milestones in my work.
Yeah, I was just wondering because you have so many publications made, and if I want to write the publication A, it's really about your PhD work.
Yes, it's my that one is my PhD in English. We call it
without any new stuff, so to say. Yeah. Okay.
No, nothing new compared to the PhD.
Well, in section two, you define and compare various approaches to information access in terms of expressivity, readability, guidance, and scalability. And And it occurred to me that one interesting, fairly new way of navigating are the recommending systems. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have recommending systems in your analysis.
Yeah,
do you think they fit well or not so well with the model?
I think about it at some time, but it was a bit difficult to fit it in it. Recommender systems are indeed can be seen as a way of information access, of course, and I would put it in query languages, but with a special kind of query, where the query is an example, is an object, and then you are asking the system to provide you related related object. So this is similar to querying by example. A bit like when you have a photo or a picture and you want to find similar pictures. There are people at Teresa working on that. But there is still a difference here in that in recommender systems, the results, they are not objects that are similar by content, but similar by context, by usage. But you can see it as you can take each object, each book, for instance, you describe it by the set of people who liked it, and then when you look at one book or want to buy a book, the system will suggest books which were liked by the same people as the book you're looking at. So for me, it's an instance of query languages with an expressivity that is corresponds to list. You get a list as a result. But where the query isn't structured, so a query is simply one object.
Yeah, there are also these content-based recommender systems are actually not based on usage of the system by others. Because they somehow extend the idea that you have here the navigational structures, because then we really don't have a kind of explicit, at least, navigational structure, but we of compute
true.
Why these other true. Nodes would be of interest at this position that you are now.
Yeah, it's true.
So it's a kind of it's a little bit different from having a navigation. And it also affects on the question of if you have a query and then you have the extension of the query and you try to compute the index, for example, it might be perhaps challenging at that moment as well.
It's true that it's probably my presentation is probably a bit oversimplifying for the purpose of clarity, but of course the different paradigms are not exclusive. I don't say that I'm the first to combine several paradigms. So, for instance, recommender systems, they can be seen as query languages, but they can also be seen as navigation structures, as you say, where the navigation structures is more dynamic. It could be computed once for all, but in reality, it's not done like this. So it's computed.
You have this interesting notion of safeness introduced here, and then you say that for example, these dead ends are an example of safeness or unsafe places. Are there other unsafe places in the navigational structure than the dead ends, so to say? Or is it the only one?
For example, if it makes sense to ask for a flight from Rennes to Washington, say. From the schema, it makes sense, but it happens that there are no such flights. So if I first start, I want a flight starting from Rennes and going to, if I want safeness, the system should not suggest me Washington as a destination.
Yes, I understand that, but are there other unsafe situations? Because it's sort of occurred that you gave that this is an example of an unsafe.
Yes.
But there are maybe some other situations that are unsafe in some other ways, or
yes. So in other ways, when the extension has a different nature. So, for instance, in the possible word explorer, the extension is a Boolean, a satisfiability test. Yeah. So here, unsafe is when it's the satisfiability is false.
Okay.
So safeness here is to be able to move to a situation, to description of a situation that is not possible in any world. So that's an example where the notion of safeness is different. For each instance of ACN, in fact, we have to consider what are the extensions and what does it mean to be safe. It's something that can be redefined for each instance indeed. It may be that in some instances it's not enough. For instance, if you want to look for frequent patterns or frequent concepts, you may say that unsafe is when frequency is less than 10, for instance, or 10% of the object. That could be another definition of sageness.
Okay.
But then that would be more difficult to prove, I guess.
Yeah, it seems that your abstraction of ACN very well covers lots of stuff. Mm. But on the other hand, when you move to the abstract, then the easier it is to create the model that matches there. And my next question is actually that it looks very nice, this abstraction model, and somehow I enjoyed reading it. But so what? What are the practical consequences of this abstraction?
I agree that from a statistical point of view, it's nearly void, because you can't prove anything from generally for all ACN instances. First of all, I would like to say that ACN, I didn't start with inventing ACN in my PhD and then using it. It's really an a posteriori vision over my previous work. So maybe in the future we'll find some limits and I will need to make it more general. But I think still that it's interesting first to understand what is common to the different instances, which may look quite disparate. But also it can be a guide. For instance, in the current PhD of Mohamed Ouba about guided composition of workflows, we use it as a guide. So we ask, what is the knowledge base? What is the query? What is the extension? And it's quite useful. And also it means that it gives you a guide as well in the design of the user interface. You know that your user interface will be a view over the current concept and with three components. Then each component can get as complex as possible or, to the contrary, get very simple. Because in the case of Pew, the extension is simply true always, so you don't need to display it anymore. But I think it's like a design pattern.
Yeah, right. These works actually somehow show it, because you have then perhaps realized that in some model there's one dimension missing, and then introducing that dimension into the search paradigm might. Yeah.
And still, the key notion is to have a query to characterize a navigation place, and query transformations as navigation links. That may be the most specific aspect.
In section 3, you mentioned that ACN is restricted only to collections of one type, and then you give examples: photos, documents, and people. But how come cannot documents and photos be searched using shared properties, for example, doubling or author?
So in ACN, you said that. What you said is about ACN, that only one kind of object can be...
So I read somewhere there.
So because this is the case in LCA, typically. In LCA, yes. In logical concept analysis, it was only possible to have one kind of object where it was possible to combine pictures, documents, and so on. Mm. But as soon as you have relationships between the different kinds of objects, it couldn't work. So for instance, if you have documents, you can describe your documents by authors, which are people.
Yeah.
And then you could put your people as objects of your context, but then they would be different. They would be, for each people, there would be an object representing it and an attribute representing it for describing the documents. And that would not be the same thing formally.
Even if they share some attributes.
So we at some time before introducing the full relational algebra, we thought about solutions like this, where to use a shared attribute to establish kind of relationships between objects and then to use some specific navigation moves on query transformation to address that. But this is a workaround for LCA, but I think the solution we had later is more robust and more elegant.
Then in the utility system, you mentioned that you don't need any preliminary preparations like forms or schemas for suggestions. Yeah. And sort of I'm not very familiar with the utilis, but it sounds to me that this kind of information like forms and schemas are very important in order to describe the system or results to the end user. So do you think doesn't it this approach then lead to problems in terms of usability from the end user's viewpoint if we are sort of ignorant about the schemas or
so? In fact, it's not that there is no schema. It's more if you have an RDF graph, you may have just the data. So you have classes and properties that are used, but you don't have a declaration of what are the classes and what are the properties. But you can discover them in data. I see. When you use instance-based guidance, you really look at the actual data to provide suggestions. And in some way, we rediscover the actual schema. But it's when you don't have the data, then you need the schema to provide some feedback to the user and some suggestion. But if you have the data, it's not completely necessary. Now, what would be useful would be still to, in the case where you have an ontology, where you don't only have the schema, but you also have the axioms that relate the different classes and properties, because then you have additional information that could be used. When we say that we don't use a priori information, we still use the hierarchy of classes and the hierarchy of properties, but we discover it from the data.
Okay.
So basically, we ask for, given a class, give me the superclasses. But it's simply RDFS.
Okay, in a way, you use schema based on the data, because the schemas can be seen then.
Yes, it's based on the schema, which is extracted from the data, but we didn't use all possible information. For instance, from what was done, we didn't use the range and domain information, and this was in future works.
Yeah. Then in the BEV system, you mentioned the idea of determining, said that missing axioms are determined by excluding satisfiable queries that should not be satisfiable, and which looks very sort of nice idea. But this reminds me of the problems of ontology debugging and things like that. That when you find something wrong or missing in the data, there are usually thousands of ways of repairing it. And have you found now the sort of the wisdom here how to do it, or
no? It's because we consider only a particular case where we only complete the ontology with additional axioms.
But even so if you have a more general correction, you don't mind. You just put.
No, the way it's done is true. We don't have much control on the shape of axioms.
Yeah.
Simply, when you find something that should not be possible, we generate an axiom that makes this impossible. But it's probable that then, if you look at the general set of generated axioms, it's not much readable.
Yeah.
But we chose to have it from a more experimental way, where you see what is possible or not, and you control this way. But there are no possibility to come back, that is, to undo some axioms or to correct axioms.
I guess then you cannot make, if there are lots of corrections to make, then it will be very, very,
yeah,
very difficult.
Yeah, also you cannot be sure to have find everything. Yeah. It's a very exploratory approach. So Sebastian Rudolph, with whom I've done the work, also made other contribution where he proposed a more systematic approach based on FCA, and it is called attribute exploration, where the system will look for every we look for every possible implication and ask the user, is this true? And the user will either say yes or provide a counterexample. And this is defined in such a way that this will be complete. Mm-hmm. But this can also be very boring for the user, which is patronized by the system and have to answer a long row of questions without any control. So this would be nice to have a kind of mix of the two.
Yeah. Okay, then a question about the SQL. A system that you made, and so you used the QALD queries to evaluate that your system indeed is capable of representing these natural language queries. But have you tested this system to end users? So that are they really useful? Because it's always the case that even if you can represent something, if you give it to me, for example, I will be completely lost.
Yeah,
possibly. So have you done this kind of...
To be honest, I didn't do user studies because I already know the results. It will be bad. Okay. So I don't expect SQL to be really usable, or maybe by some expert people who would really be motivated to learn it. But it was more a side work to acquire knowledge on the master about control natural languages. I wanted to know better the mapping between natural languages and formal languages, and I saw that formal control natural languages such as ACE are really good, really interesting in that purpose. And then I reused techniques that I learned on the, by developing Swirl into SparkList to verbalize the queries into natural language. But then this was, I used similar techniques and results, but in a different way. Because in Swirl, I start from a sentence in control natural language, and I have to translate it in Sparker through an intermediate representation. But in SparkList, for instance, or CWLIS, I start from an internal representation, which is intermediate between natural language and Sparkle. And then I translate that to control natural language. So it works the other way around. And I really think that even if you allow for a full natural language, it can be difficult for the user. Of course, the user is able to output a natural question, but if he doesn't know exactly what he is looking for, if he doesn't know exactly what kind of data is available, if he doesn't know the vocabulary, then it's very difficult. So I think I prefer to explore an approach where I guide the user, so step by step in the construction of the sentence. So, okay. So Squirrel is more an intermediate result. It's not redesigned for any end users. Mm-hmm. And there is another difficulty with Squirrel is that I didn't work on the lexical aspect, which means that you have to specify the URIs for nouns and verbs are URIs, so you have to specify the URIs. So you have to know the schema and the RDA vocabulary very precisely. But then it would be possible to apply techniques like was done for ACE on ACE Wiki, with an auto-completion mechanism and with a lexicon for a specific domain.
Okay. Yeah.
That would be possible.
Yeah. My final question is a generic one. If you would have to pick up the biggest lesson or most important lesson that you have learned during this project, what would it be? And what would you do differently if you started all this stuff again now?
The most important lessons? it's probably something to do with, I think the most important lesson is probably about the interaction between implementation and formalization. I know that I started during my PhD, during very theoretical works on paper, going very far, and then implementing it in order to apply it. And now I know that I work differently. I find it more dynamic to have more intricated loops of formalization and implementation. And if you use a sufficiently high-level programming language, then this can be quite interesting because it gives you constraints. When you have to express it in a programming language in a high level without considering low-level details, then it's very demanding and you have to think of many cases, and then you can back to formalization. And I've seen that this produces more useful theories on the better quality software as well. So maybe that would be one lesson.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So the third reviewer is Professor Norbert Fuchs from University of Zurich. Please.
Being the third, and after the extensive thank you by Madame Isha and Professor Yuen, there's not much left for me, so let me just say thank you for having been invited and having not only the work but also the pleasure of reading your thesis and of listening to your presentation. I would like to start with a rather general or maybe personal question. In the very beginning, you said, looking back at your work and preparing the thesis, you found a common pattern, namely ACN. Was this a kind of a revelation, or this is what I did, or was this a kind of relief? Finally, I have a handle to get all this stuff together.
It's mostly that when I wanted to prepare this habilitation and didn't know exactly how to do it, I was not quite motivated by just collating a lot of parts of papers and just I really needed a red line to motivate me and to give me a motivation and a logic to write the habilitation. And so I looked for something, a common pattern, indeed. In fact, as you notice, maybe you or I don't remember, notice that it was ACN is obviously inspired by query-based faceted search. Mm-hmm. And indeed, as at that time, the query-based faceted search was really the most salient contribution or state of the art in my work. I started from it, and I wonder, does it apply to other works? And when I've seen that it matched well, yeah, I was quite happy. And now I think it's kind of obvious for me, and I find it useful. But I don't think I would say it was a revelation, mm-hmm. but it brought a lot of clarification. And I'm really happy now to have found this, and that made the writing of my habilitation thesis much more interesting.
As you said before, it could help you to more or less to have criteria for further approaches, or there could be something missing. This aspect is not there. I was struck by another comment of yours on slide 31. You said there are other criteria that contribute to power and usability, and then on the following slides you talked about perspectives concerning expressivity and usability. But did you mean more? Further criteria that contribute to power and usability besides expressivity and usability?
I think if you consider power and usability, I think it covers it all. Everything can be reduced to some power and what can you do with it. Mm-hmm. And some usability, how many people can use it and with which degree of ease. Yeah. Then I think it's each of these axes that can be refined in a lot of ways. Even guidance, I've seen that we can refine it with guidance safeness, guidance completeness, and scalability. We discussed that we can understand it in several ways. It's definitely not fixed and limited. And in particular, for usability, it's not so easy. I've listed a few, such as personalization, learnability. But learnability is in addition to that, the different criteria are not independent. We can imagine that readability and learnability are not independent, they interfere with each other.
Okay. I actually had expected that you would talk a little bit more about Squall, but you mentioned it's only on the side, and you just said, as an answer to a question of Professor Hüven, it was one of a kind of a sideline. But nevertheless, I would like to come back to this. Mm-hmm. I was struck a little bit by the deviation you introduced into the grammar compared to the standard grammar of English. For example, the third person singular with a hyphen S and the plural with a hyphen S. Why did you use this?
I use this because my position to start with was to be independent of a particular vocabulary, a particular data set. So at the lexical level, it's quite limited. So that's why there is a if and s, just so that the system can extract the URI from that. Because if you collate the s, then it will put it in the URI. So that's the reason for the if and s.
Yeah.
And that's why also it's not so, there are some unnatural forms, because that would, natural form would require to introduce a flexion, a variation of the word.
Some kind of morphology or more rich lexicon
exactly,
or so, yeah. Did you ever plan to give up this kind of limitation to come closer to the standard English?
Yeah, the plan to, that would be very interesting indeed, to, what I would like to keep genericity would be to have an external representation of the vocabulary for some domain and for some language, or for English in that case, and then to be able to consume that to allow for more natural forms. Yeah. This is in my projects indeed. But it's what's difficult is that it's not enough to have a direct mapping between one word on one URI. It covers a number of cases, but that's not enough. Sometimes you have to match one word to a graph pattern, mm-hmm. and sometimes you have to match a combination of words to one URI. So there can be an N relationships between words on the URIs, on graph patterns. So, and I've not found much work on how to represent this.
Yeah, I was wondering how this affects the learnability or usability of the language. We notice in our work that even since we don't have these kind of deviations from standard grammar, that nevertheless the language has to be learned, and that learning takes some time. But this, you see, these kind of artificial elements increase the learning effort. You have to recall more stuff, and so in my view, it could negatively affect the usability of the language. Do you agree?
Yes, I agree. Sure, a control natural language has to be learned, and the more artificial it is, and the more constrained it is, the more it has to be learned. But at the same time, if it tries to cope with really full English and to cover many constructs, then this means you have more things to learn if you want to still know the distinction. Or you can just hope that you will cover everything, but then you get closer to the full natural language interfaces. I also had the idea that if my constructions are a bit artificial, but there are few of them, then it can be learned relatively quickly. So you would have to learn it like a formal language, knowing the grammar in some sense, but easier to remember because close to English. But I have not made no user studies.
Yeah, so that would be very interesting to make a user study and. For example, compare this to a visibly formal language and see how people react to this. The last question is concerning the expressivity of Squall. You're not targeting Sparkle. So is this, are you ever extending to have expressivity that goes beyond Sparkle?
I do not consider it much. I just identify in one case. There is one missing feature of Sparkle in Squall. It's a transitive property path. So this corresponds to a form of recursivity. So I thought about it a little bit, and I found that if I were to add it to Squall, I would have to add it in a more general way, and then I would add recursivity in a full fashion, and that would go somewhat beyond Sparkle. Then.
Okay, thank you very much.
Honor Odom again, Karel Berthet from University of La Rochelle.
Yes, thanks. So my comment and question will be in French.
Yes.
First of all, d'abord, oui, j'ai beaucoup apprécié la vision, comme a dit Marianne, par rapport au cadre formel que tu as présenté, qui permet de positionner donc toutes ces approches au sein d'un même cadre et donc de pouvoir les comparer les unes par rapport aux autres. Ce qui m'intéresse aussi tout particulièrement et ce que j'ai beaucoup apprécié, c'est d'avoir su exploiter à ce point de cette façon-là l'espace de recherche sous-jacent aux données pour pouvoir naviguer de place en place à l'aide de liens. Et surtout le fait que tout ça repose sur une connexion de Galois entre des objets, des espaces de description, des propriétés très formelles aussi de systèmes de fermeture, d'opérateurs de fermeture et ce genre de choses. Qui sont des éléments pas évidents non plus à manipuler et que tu as manipulé sans aucun problème pour pouvoir proposer ce cadre méthodologique. À ce niveau-là, donc moi j'aurais plusieurs questions. La première question, c'est que tous tes travaux concernant l'analyse, l'approche de description des objets par des formules logiques et l'extension de la connexion de Galois dans cet espace de description logique. Ça, c'est des choses que je connaissais. Je connaissais tes travaux par rapport à ça. Par contre, là, j'ai découvert ton approche avec les cubes et j'ai du mal à repositionner la connexion de Galois et les systèmes de fermeture par rapport aux cubes. À quoi est-ce que ça correspond exactement?
D'accord. Alors, bon, je vais switcher vers un petit slide qui va peut-être permettre d'appuyer ma réponse. Donc en fait, il faut se poser la question de comment on instancie les différents composants de la CN pour avoir les cubes. En fait, ce qu'on peut voir, c'est que la différence, on a le même contexte quasiment. Simplement, on va distinguer au niveau des formules qui décrivent les objets, plutôt que simplement parler d'une formule indifférenciée. On va dire qu'il y a une partie attribut, une partie valeur. Et les valeurs, elles, peuvent être définies de façon logique comme précédemment. Et c'est utile parce qu'en fait, les attributs vont jouer le rôle, vont être utilisés comme dimension, comme mesure dans la définition des cubes. Voilà. Avec une spécificité par rapport au contexte many-valued qu'on a en FCA, que pour un objet, peut avoir 0, 1 ou plusieurs valeurs pour chaque attribut. D'accord ? Donc ensuite, ce qui change, on a une requête comme en LCA, et après, mais par contre, cette requête au sens ACN, elle est augmentée d'un ensemble de dimensions. Donc là, la dimension, on a donc un vecteur d'attributs. Hein, chaque dimension est un attribut et va définir une dimension du cube. Ensuite, on va aussi choisir un certain nombre d'attributs pour définir des mesures. Et pour chaque attribut, on peut également choisir un opérateur d'agrégation. Donc en fait, tout ça, ça définit la requête maintenant. Et l'extension, ça devient des cubes, puisqu'on va calculer pour chaque dimension et pour chaque valeur possible de chaque dimension. En fait, on crée un tableau à n dimensions. Et dans chacune de ces cellules, on va regarder la valeur des attributs d'agrégation et de mesure, et on va faire des agrégations. Donc là, le premier opérateur de la connexion de Galois, c'est ça, c'est l'extension, qui permet de générer un cube de concept et cube de valeur. Et ensuite, dans l'autre sens, en fait, ça ne change pas tellement. On voit au niveau l'index hein, qui correspond à l'intention. Ça, c'est défini pareil sur l'union de sur les réponses de la requête. En fait. Et donc, tout choix dans l'index pour affiner la requête ou pour affiner les dimensions et tout va avoir pour effet de sélectionner un sous-ensemble du cube ou d'augmenter d'une dimension, etc. Donc, c'est en fait, on amène de la structure au niveau de la requête et au niveau de l'extension. Je ne sais pas si ça répond à
ta question. Oui, en fait, on évolue dans un espace de description qui est un espace à deux dimensions, comme des histogrammes, en fait.
Oui, c'est... Ouais, voilà, c'est
d'accord. Et du coup, ça, c'est combiné avec aussi les formules logiques des objets.
Donc oui, voilà, les formules, elles interviennent au niveau des valeurs, c'est-à-dire que dans le cube, les valeurs là, qui représentent les lignes et les colonnes, sont des formules logiques, des propriétés logiques, et on exploite aussi, dans ce cas-là, la relation de généralisation qu'on a là, pour faire les opérations qu'on qualifie en OLAP de roll-up et de drill-down, qui correspond à monter ou descendre dans le niveau de généralisation de description. Voilà. Et donc ça donne... Ça c'est un exemple de résultat qu'on obtient. Donc là on a la requête. Donc là on a sélectionné tout ce qui était article ou de journal ou de conférence dans les années 2000. Et on a deux dimensions, l'auteur des documents, le type de document. Donc là, on retrouve les auteurs. Là, on trouve le type de document. Donc on voit ça deux dimensions ici. Et dans chaque cellule, on a choisi l'année, de projeter l'année de publication. On n'agrège pas, mais on affiche sous forme d'un nuage de tag. Donc on peut voir, par exemple, que Bedel, en article de conférence, il a publié en 2006, 2007 et 2008, et qu'il y en avait deux en 2006. Voilà, c'est le genre de représentation qu'on peut avoir. Mais si tu regardes l'index, il est le même que ce qu'on a dans Camelis, par exemple. Et il est calculé sur l'ensemble des documents qui sont sous-jacents à ce cube. Donc en fait, ça, une autre façon de le voir, c'est de dire que pour chaque dimension, c'est comme si on disait, mets l'auteur dans la requête, mais par contre, je ne veux pas choisir l'auteur. Donc c'est comme si on suivait plein de chemins de navigation en parallèle. Et ensuite, je veux regarder les types, mais n'importe lequel. Et donc là, ça crée un espace à deux dimensions. Voilà. Et en plus, ça, c'est plus un aspect d'affichage de résultats.
J'avais aussi une autre question par rapport à tes perspectives. Tu mettais en perspective des travaux sur tout ce qui était personnalisation, prendre en compte le profil de l'utilisateur, où on se rapproche là des systèmes de recommandation. Ouais. Est-ce que tu as regardé ce qui se passait dans tout ce qui était analyse triadique et système à trois dimensions, où justement la troisième dimension peut être utilisé comme étant le profil de l'utilisateur?
Okay, effectivement, ça je ne connais pas très bien techniquement, mais ça pourrait être effectivement intéressant. Bon, on sait que les contextes triadiques, on peut les représenter de façon relationnelle. Mm-hmm. Puisqu'à chaque fois, on a donc la triadique, c'est une association entre un document, un mot-clé et un utilisateur, profil. Voilà, mm-hmm. ou un profil. Donc c'était l'utilisateur a mis tel mot-clé sur tel document. Donc là, ça fait une relation ternaire. Alors ça, en RDF, quand on est limité aux relations binaires, c'est un petit peu embêtant, mais on peut passer par la réification. On va créer un objet qui est de type annotation. Et on va dire que cette annotation, elle s'applique à un document. Elle a un certain mot-clé et elle est faite par un certain utilisateur. Et donc ensuite, après, par interrogation, bon, on peut interroger ça, mais ce que je pense que fait l'analyse triadique, c'est d'exhiber certains patterns, certains motifs récurrents.
Oui, ou alors sous forme de règles aussi, mais la particularité, c'est que les places sont composées non pas de deux ensembles, extension et tension, mais de trois ensembles.
Ouais,
et donc, on peut interroger sur un des trois ensembles.
D'accord.
Le troisième étant le profil.
Mais ça serait intéressant, effectivement, de voir dans quelle mesure ça se superpose. Est-ce qu'on peut reproduire certaines choses que font ce qui est fait dans l'analyse triadique ici et en termes d'espace de navigation, effectivement.
Il me semble effectivement qu'il peut y avoir des choses intéressantes, mais le formalisme est assez, à mon avis, pourrait être simplifié.
Oui, d'accord.
Moi, j'ai pas mal travaillé en images aussi, vu que j'ai un laboratoire d'images, où on a des approches, classification, fouille de données. Et surtout, on s'intéresse à des techniques qui sont des annotations automatiques, avec des approches qui sont plutôt des approches ascendantes, où on veut construire justement le modèle des données à partir des objets, avec un utilisateur qui va pouvoir sélectionner des groupes d'objets, les annoter, pour avoir une approche non pas descendante mais ascendante. Est-ce que tu penses que ça serait possible de fournir les outils justement pour un système de construction automatique du modèle des données à partir de données brutes?
J'ai envie de dire que dès qu'on a envie de guider l'utilisateur dans la construction de quelque chose, on peut essayer d'appliquer ACN justement, c'est un petit peu sa valeur, quoi, son avantage. Donc effectivement, on pourrait se poser la question. Donc, le langage de requête, en fait, ça s'appelle requête, mais il faut voir ça plus généralement. On a vu que ça pouvait être une mise à jour, on a vu que ça pouvait être un workflow. Donc il faut spécifier, formaliser le langage de ce qu'on veut construire. Donc là, les modèles, par exemple, ou les annotations. Ensuite, bien sûr, il faut se demander quelles sont les données. Ce seraient toutes les images, mais éventuellement aussi, dedans, il y aurait tous les moyens d'extraire des descripteurs des images, parce que j'imagine que ça s'appuie sur ça. Et ensuite, faut se demander qu'est-ce qu'on propose comme index, quoi, comme suggestion. Qu'est-ce qu'on a envie d'ajouter dans le modèle en construction et comment on peut le calculer de façon instance-based. C'est ça qui peut être un peu plus délicat. Donc si on a vraiment des instances, bon, on peut s'appuyer dessus pour le faire. Si on n'en a pas, comme dans l'approche Possible World Explorer, on peut envisager de s'appuyer sur un raisonneur, par exemple. Donc ça peut être un guide, après je ne sais pas ce que ça donnerait, mais ça peut être une piste.
En termes d'expressivité de toutes ces approches-là, quand on parle de logique de description, on est donc dans la logique du premier ordre. On sait que les approches analyse formelle des concepts restent des approches très conjonctives. Où est-ce que tu situes donc cette approche-là entre la logique du premier ordre et l'approche classique analyse formelle des concepts?
Alors, ça se place à des niveaux différents. En fait, on peut combiner les deux de façon assez orthogonale, c'est-à-dire que dans les logiques de description, l'expressivité qui est apportée, c'est une expressivité en termes d'inférence, de raisonnement. Donc je dirais ça en trois couches, on a les données factuelles, ensuite on a une ontologie, par exemple à base de logique de description, qui permet de définir certaines inférences, et ce qui en fait permet d'augmenter la base de faits, avec des faits induits. Et au-dessus de ça, on peut mettre donc ce que j'ai présenté, qui est plus sur le mode d'un langage d'interrogation, un peu comme ce qu'on a dans les bases de données avec l'hypothèse du monde clos. Donc on peut imaginer combiner les deux. Par exemple, si les points d'accès SparkQL ils commencent à avoir la capacité à faire de l'inférence, on leur pose une requête en SparkQL, mais derrière ils font l'inférence qu'il faut pour avoir des réponses complètes, si mon système s'appliquera tel quel sans modification. Et donc on peut avoir une expressivité forte au niveau de l'inférence et faible au niveau de l'interrogation, ou inversement, comme actuellement, plutôt faible au niveau de l'inférence et assez élevé en termes d'interrogation. Voilà, c'est parce qu'il y a le niveau vraiment inférence, qu'est-ce qu'on peut déduire des faits, et il y a le niveau plus interroger les données. Après, pour des niveaux d'expressivité importants de logique de description, ça peut devenir quand même un peu compliqué, parce que si on ne peut pas matérialiser tous les faits induits, c'est-à-dire qu'il faut qu'il y ait quand même une coopération entre le moteur de requête et le moteur de raisonnement. Donc ça, il y a des gens qui travaillent sur ça pour Ontology Based Data Access, qui essayent de voir comment on peut répondre à des questions par rapport à une ontologie.
J'avais une dernière question, mais en fait, c'est pas encore très très clair pour moi. Donc, je pense que je vais y réfléchir un petit peu. Je te la poserai très certainement plus tard, parce qu'actuellement, je m'intéresse à des techniques de décomposition de l'espace de recherche sur en facteurs, en fait. Donc, ça qui permettrait d'avoir des vues, mais des vues qui sont fournies automatiquement à partir des données, donc pouvoir pour voir comment on pourrait l'exploiter pour un mécanisme après de recherche d'informations interactives. Mais bon, il faut que j'y réfléchisse un peu, donc on en parlera plus tard.
Ok, avec plaisir.
Merci. And now some questions about the semantic web aspects of your work by Fabien Gandon from INRIA.
Maybe. So I say I have no choice of the domain. Okay, so first of all, I'd like to stress that I was really pleased to be invited, because I think the subject you've chosen is extremely important. I believe that in the semantic web community in particular, HCI interaction have not been a first citizen all the time, and so pushing that aspect and stressing the importance of the interaction with the users is really important. The second thing is I really appreciated the choices you made for writing your thesis. I think it's a very efficient choice with this first 70-page synthesis and then the article that allows us to have both the overview and the ability to find the technical detail when we need. That's a good choice, very efficient. And the third point I wanted to stress, that I really appreciated the work you did on thinking about a unifying model, the ACN. I think it's extremely important in the context of an habilitation defense, because what is asked to you is, do you have an overview? Do you have a strategy, a scientific strategy? Do you know where you're going? And so taking this step back, having an overview, proposing a unifying model and using that to actually evaluate your next step is exactly a sort of thing which is important to show for this kind of defense. So I think it was a really good job. So I have a number of questions. Of course, you've been actually questioned for now an hour and 14 minutes. So I'll try to make that as painless as possible.
Thank you.
So first of all, one thing which I would I'm missing in the beginning of this, and especially at the beginning of the ACN discussion, I think it's important for you to make it clear, is the definition of your users and the definition of the tasks. Because there are many research tasks, searching tasks, and there are many. There is exploratory search, there is information retrieval with precise needs, and you need to identify the different search and say the one you are targeting. And I'll come back to that. If you had one to choose right now, what is what is the research task, the task exactly you are targeting?
So what I would target first, as users, I would target users who are specific, specialist experts about some domain, such as biology, stain biology, or bioinformation, bioinformatics, and or geographers in a geographical information system. I think I would target those users first, rather than any layman users, maybe later. And so as a task, that would be analytical queries to have a broad envelope of it, but rather precise queries. I think that's what fits better, best with.
The reason why I'm mentioning that is I know you know, but I think you have to make it explicit at the beginning that there is the whole range of tasks and a whole range of user, and that you are targeting this one, and that the ACN may be relevant for other one, and that will come in the future. So number two is here. Abilis and the Cube. So I'm no expert in OLAPs. However, my understanding that in this domain, when you define your dimensions and you define the views, that allows you to do some pre-processing to be more efficient when you do the analytics behind.
I agree.
And so what you introduce, I have the feeling that the pre-processing may become extremely costly because you relax the number of constraints. You didn't talk about that. Is it the case? Is there a problem with scalability?
I'm conscious of the difficulty. I know that many works in OLAP focused on the scalability and the efficiency of responses. So we didn't really address that. We really wanted to show that it's possible to have the expressivity of OLAP integrated with the rest. And obviously, this has consequences on scalability. But I've seen recently that there is more and more people considering that it is not so necessary today to do a lot of pre-computation, and that now we may be able to do it in a more flexible way. I've seen that written a few times, so maybe we are just lucky that it will work
as a hybrid approach, as you were mentioning before, where part of it can be done before the querying and part of it can be done as a backward chaining during the querying.
Exactly. We can imagine that if there is a frequent cube, a frequent view, that there is some pre-computation. And I would like just to add that I use Parkly sometimes to do some analytical queries on DBpedia or something like that. And it works. Sometimes it's a bit lengthy, but it doesn't fail.
Okay, good to point. About utilis now. That's a place where I was expecting a discussion on the notion of safeness. Because the intuitive definition you give is the users should not end up with zero results. But in the case of utilis, you actually want to push him to that because that's where he's going to contribute. So I was surprised that safeness was not discussed.
I missed that bit. It's true that safeness is no more relevant here because here you want objects, even if they don't match exactly the query. On the way, but then you can ask question, how do you reach that point? Because you're not supposed to go there. So the thing is that what happens is that when you want to describe your object, at some point you don't find among the suggestions what you want to put in the update, because nothing exists like this. And here you have an additional control in the user interface, which enables the user to say, give me more suggestions. Relax the query to give me more suggestions. And then you can relax and add more, get more and more suggestions and more examples. And so you never get empty results, simply that you can extend the set of results to less similar objects by relaxing, asking to relax the query. It's the way it happens.
So closer to the semantic web now. I'm getting there. I'm getting there, don't worry. Is the so you made it clear in your document that you're not that much driven by the schema. However, every time you talk about natural language access or control language access, there is here a link to the terminological level of the schemas and the data, the need for labels, maybe the needs for literal attached to that, because some schemas, the URIs in it, they are just meaningless, or the the term that was chosen from a logical point of view may be very hard for a user to guess. And so the terminological level of the schema may be very useful in that case to have an interaction with that. What's your take on it? Do you think we need to do some progress here from a terminological level of the schemas on the semantic web, the documentation of the schemas? Yeah. And also, what happens when we have a purely schema-less approach like the one you have in some of the approaches?
So here I really hope that other people will work on the definition of lexicon, so the terminological descriptions of the vocabulary, because that would be really useful. I don't think I'm competent to develop that, but that would be really great, because that would enable to retain the genericity of the approach and still to make it really more natural and more specific to data. And ideally, I would like that information to be right in the data set so that you can query it. And there is an existing meta vocabulary called Lemon to describe such knowledge, but it's really complex, and I think it would be difficult to query on the live. So I think, I would really encourage people to do work on that. I think this is missing the semantic web, because I think I can hear many people in the semantic web agreeing that natural language is very important for bringing semantic web to more people. And so we need resources that make the connection between natural language and the semantic web data and schemas. So that's my line here.
Yeah. I know you looked at the Qualled community.
Yes.
Which I think they have an element of answer for that.
Yes. I discussed a bit with them, Sebastian Walter and Christina Unger, and I know they work on that. On the I'm looking at that. Yeah.
And by the way, on that point, that's just a detail, but when you presented, you actually identified the ontology-guided approaches and the instance-guided approaches. Mm-hmm. I think there is a case for a third part, and you actually mentioned it with the collaboration at the end, which is the usage mining-guided, or the approaches that are learning from the previous queries. Mm. Of course, they suffer from the cold start problem, but combining all that.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it would be very interesting. So I think this is a big direction to go to the more collaborative tasks.
And a very quick last question, and then I'll have wrap-up comment, is on the ACN themselves. It seems to me that you characterize each one of your work through as an ACN family, in fact. So you are instance, if you prefer.
Instance. Yeah.
But when you look at the user searching for information, he may be moving from an exploratory search to a specific search and back and forth. So in other terms, if I transpose that to your view, and if I'm not mistaken, he might be moving from an ACN to another one for a given. And so what I was expecting to see at one point is there a case to be made to have several ACN system represent the link between them, the way you can switch from one to another, or is it for you just a bigger ACN encompassing both? What's your take on it?
So it's true I presented the different instances because as distinct, because they correspond to different works at different times. But the objective would certainly need to mix some of them, and we have already done that. So for instance, in CWLIS, we have the query-based SSH search and the UTILIS thing in the same interface working together. And it's relatively easy there because it's the same query language, the same formal language. And then it's just that for the extension, by default, it returns you the exact answers, but then you can ask for the relaxed answers. And the Abilis cubes of concept approach has also been integrated more recently in SparkList with the ability to specify dimensions on grouping and aggregation. So those three are already merged in some way. And then for a possible word explorer that would, if you have, it's not done yet, but you could imagine that if the system made a distinction between the ontology and the data, then you could say, okay, forget about data, just reason on the ontological level, for instance. Or we could imagine additional controls to switch. Then if the formal language is different, then it may be more difficult because then you have a more important switch. Imagine.
Yeah, it's a sort of switch you will find in visual data analytics, people moving from a perspective to another, from a tool to another, to switch. So just to conclude, You mentioned a number of perspectives. In the domain of the semantic web, I think you also have a highway for you right now, because as you know, one of the evolution of the current semantic web standard is to go toward validation. So with the new working group called Shapes, where they're going to create constraints to validate the data. Mm-hmm. And constraints, they look like queries, yeah, furiously. Cool. Yeah. So you have a road there, yeah, to have help people building constraints, I believe.
Good to know.
From a querying point of view, you know that the spectrum of querying mechanism is being augmented. You saw presentation on linked data fragments.
Yeah.
And one of the questions would be, can you do the same on top of fragments, for instance?
Yeah, it just that's true, yeah.
Instead of, which actually answer part of the scalability problem,
yeah,
by the
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
And on the spreadsheet point of view, you also have a road, because there are two groups, I mean, on the data on the web point of view, generally. The CSV on the web working group is currently working on templates, which give rules to extract CSV data into linked data, so rules again.
Okay.
And you have the same for R2RML from our relational database to the RDF model,
yeah,
and there are templates and there are rules there,
yeah,
again. So I think you have plenty of things,
okay,
so you could look at. I would also think it would be great to have collaboration with the CHI or InfoVis communities,
mm,
for you to work on the evaluation interaction aspect and design interaction,
yeah,
aspects that could be very interesting. The HCIR community,
yeah,
also, human computer information retrieval and visual data analytics. And I really appreciated several comments. I appreciated the comment implementation as a formalization. I can only agree with that one. And I wanted to stress that your work's been noticed in the semantic web community as a very original one. You really created a lot of interest there, because you are tackling aspects that have not really been tackled before. And I would conclude by saying that we need more work like this one, stressing that the point that expressivity is not an enemy of interaction, but it could be actually a help in designing better interaction,
yeah,
because too many times expressivity is used only in the back end of the system.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I would like to start by telling you how much I liked both your document and your talk, in particular. As some of my colleagues already said, I really much liked the effort that you made to find a unifying paradigm, abstract conceptual navigation. I think it gave a lot of coherence to your presentation, and it makes it also easier to read, probably, rather than a collection of works, as you said. Concerning my questions, I don't work exactly in the same domain as you, even though we are in the same department. I'm more a database person, but I see some connections between what you do and the topics I work on. So I will try to ask you some questions about this, about some possible extensions of your work, possible or maybe impossible, I don't know. As you may know, in databases, in the last decade, there is a topic that has attracted a lot of attention. It's how to introduce preferences in user queries. So many approaches have been proposed, top K queries, CPNet, Skyline, and fuzzy logic based approaches. In your approaches, it's still Boolean queries, I'm right?
Yes.
And how difficult do you think it would be to introduce preferences in these approaches? I think that somewhere you say that you can define a system using some basic building blocks that you call the logic functors, I think. So
yes.
Can we imagine to have some fuzzy logic functors, for example?
Yeah, I think that's a possibility indeed. We could imagine to have... The way to do it would be to extend either the logic or the query in order to include in it the preferences and some values. And then ideally, we would like also to guide users in the definition of those preferences, allowing them to select some degree of satisfaction that is expected. So this could be done, I think, through the query language. And then if that preference, those preferences are expressed in the query, then the query engine can be defined using your work, for instance, to compute the set of results. And in addition, we would get a ranking of the results. And we have not worked that much on the ranking, not at all, in fact. So we just present the list of results, and we just count on the interaction to reduce the set to a manageable set. But this is compatible with having a ranking of the results, and I think that would be useful because from the beginning, you would have a better feedback with more salient or more interesting answers from the beginning. And then maybe that would be a way as well to shorten the navigation, the interaction, to need less navigation steps in order to find something.
Yeah, by the way, I think that there are a few works, but for example, faceted search with preferences, but it's still a rather new topic. And I really have the feeling we could do something together in that domain. My second question, it's also a hot topic in databases, let's say, even though it's a problem that has been identified in the 80s, it's only recently that people put a lot of effort in trying to improve the systems. It's about the fact that in general we don't have information that is certain about the real world. We have a lot of imperfection, uncertainty. Here, I think you consider that you have data, information that is certain, and you produce answers that are also certain. But again, how difficult would it be to take into account the imperfections that can be attached to information? From a logical point of view, maybe you could use things like probabilistic logic or possibilistic logic, I don't know.
I don't know.
It's probably a bigger issue than the first one I mentioned.
First, I would say that we don't assume necessarily certain data. We just take data as it is. But it's true that the results are as if data was certain. I agree. But we often observe that using our systems, we could quickly identify errors or heterogeneity in data or inconsistencies. So this may not address the problem of uncertain data, but at least it seems to be a good tool to discover problems in data.
It would probably raise some complexity issues because in databases, at least when you have to deal with disjunctive values and even more weighted disjunctive values, it's much more costful.
Yes, it can be very costly. It's a bit like with reasoning, with answering under reasoning, then it can be much more complex than simple query answering. What could be done maybe would be to use query relaxation as we've done in with Utilis for the update, but here just for querying. We could imagine that if some data is uncertain, but if you allow for relaxation, then you will still find the answer even if there is an error in it. And then it would be up to the user to look at each answer to see how it differs from the current query. But another remark that I can do is that if you know that some properties are more reliable than others, then the strategy for the users is to first put the constraints on the more reliable constraints, and then to see what.
But if you want to preserve all the information that you have, it's even better to keep, for example, to associate a probability with the different alternatives.
And then we can apply a similar technique than for preferences.
I agree that it's certainly not something easy to do. My third question was about some possible link with the domain of cooperative answering. So in some of your systems, you talked about relaxation. Cooperative answering can mean many different things. It can be to give the user extra information that he didn't explicitly ask for. It can be relaxing the question in case of an empty answer, or on the contrary, strengthening it in case of a plethoric answer. So you have some mechanisms like that. In terms of relaxation, if I understood well.
Yes, relaxation is an example. And I can see another example. So for instance, more recently in Sparklist, when you look for answers, it will give you more information than you would get if you had written the question. I don't know if you want to see... I don't have an example like this. Just that by default, it will show you not only one column. If you look for films with the highest budget, for instance, it will not give you just the name of the film. Okay. It will give you the film, its budget, and not only for the first, for the highest budget, but also the second, the third, and the fourth, so that you get some context. You can see, okay, this is the film with the highest budget, here is its budget, and the second, the film with the second highest budget is that one with that budget, so this gives you some context. So this is another example where more information is given to the user than what he would expect first.
And about relaxation, you have it in Utilis, that's mm-hmm. right, but not in some of your other...
It's in Cewelis, it's integrated in Cewelis. Okay. In fact, Utilis is a component.
But in Squall, for example, you don't have that.
Sorry?
In Squall.
No.
But we could think about it.
Some people have proposed to extend Sparkle with a relax keyword, which would enable to say, okay, that graph pattern, you can relax it, mm-hmm. and then sort the answers by increasing relaxation.
The problem is that in general, you have many different ways to relax a question.
Yes. So
I also had a question. It's about something that you say in your document. When you do some directed search, you can face a situation where, in fact, you have a large set of suggestions that you can make to the user. Yeah. Have you thought about using some data mining techniques, for example, query mining techniques take into account the most frequent questions that have been asked or things like that?
It's true. So far, we sort the suggestion from the most frequent to the least frequent because otherwise, usually, you don't want to restrict too quickly your answer set. But it's true that the navigation history of the user himself or of a community of users could be indeed very useful to push up the more interesting suggestions. So that would fit into the personalization perspective mm-hmm. about guidance. And we've done nothing so far about it.
Okay, and my last question, I don't know if it makes sense, but you didn't, except if I missed something, but I don't think you really try to apply your ideas to the information retrieval systems, documents, trying to retrieve documents. Is it because the data model is too poor, semantically speaking? But we could consider XML documents where you have a structure. And do you think it would make sense to apply your concepts?
I guess it would make sense, but it's true that this approach is really for structured data. We could not apply it directly to text because there would need a way to represent to the text in a structured way. So, of course, that would be very interesting, but then I consider that I need to rely on other works that extract some structured information from text on which I can then navigate. For XML, it's a good remark indeed. We could consider applying exactly the same approach to XML and using XQuery as a target query language, for instance, and so on. So that would be parallel to what has been done here for the semantic web.
Yeah, I was surprised, in fact, that you didn't do it already, but you cannot do everything, of course.
No, I can do everything on the... I find it more interesting to work on the semantic web today, especially because it's more semantic. Maybe the XML is about syntactic structures. Even it has some content, but the structure is really
it's
syntactical.
It's of course not as rich as...
It's not as expressive, as rich as a semantic web.
Okay, thank you. So I think now we can move to another room to discuss and write the report.